Yeah, that's quite a thought, eh? Singing, saying, "You're worthy of it all, Lord." My title is a little bit, yeah. Those won't be demons manifesting, I promise. For the visitors, there's just a bit of an inside joke there. I had a very wild past, and I often help with deliverance, so I'm not the chief demon hunter. I'm just a servant. And sometimes the Lord uses me in those spaces. So just to settle all the nerves, if there are any, please. This morning is really, it's really a little bit of an introspection, a little bit of a just sharing, just something that I've really felt so incredibly burdened by, and that the Lord's been really working with me personally in my life. In this space, certainly in the last couple of months, there's been a really, really intensive journey. I've got a Bulgarian bullfrog again. So this concept of having an idol is just, I'm a Christian, Lord, and I've been a believer for many years, and I've even served you, as a pastor, as a leader, as a servant in the house for many, many years, I'm not an idolater. Am I speaking to myself? I don't do that other stuff, I don't worship things. But then it kind of, the Lord just took me up short a little bit, and then he taught me this. Oh, thanks, brother. Just put my other next slide up for me there, please. It's quite a thought, that, eh? An idol is everything or anything that you serve more, love more, fear more, or trust more than God. And like, the Lord really took me in the face and went, "So Helmut, what do you trust more? If you do something well, then you trust that you'll be rewarded for it. When you do something better than most, do you go, 'I'm the peanut here, bro. Watch me spin my wheels. Let me take care of that for you, because I know better than you.'" And what really shook me is how kind and how loving is that? How helpful is that? My dad, in his love for me, had a habit that when I was about 10% into a task and I wasn't getting it right quick enough, he'd just do it for me. And in his heart, he was being 100% sincere. But in my heart, he was taking away my ability to learn. And I think in many ways, and I use that as one example, but I think all of us have got an example like that. There's a thing where someone just does something and it sort of almost steamrolls over you. And you get like, just take a back seat because I'm in charge here. And you're like, well, can I have a chance to grow? Can I have a chance to learn? Can I have a chance to develop a bit? And in light of all of this, there's something that I hear often in Christian circles. We want revival. I mean, let's be honest. As a leader in the church, you want revival. You want it to break out in the congregation you're in. You want to see it happen around you, right? We want to see revival. Am I the only one? Looks like it, yeah. Oh, there's two of us. We got a chance, two or more gathered, eh, right? We want revival. Here's the problem with revival. Something has to die in order for it to be revived. Something has to die. And sometimes, and I certainly want to say the last while, the Lord's been telling me that there's something in me that needs to die. There's something that I have to let go of. And I'm speaking to Helmut, but I'm sure that I'm being heard by some as well. There's something that that I need to take out of me. I jokingly refer to it as the unholy trinity. Do you know what that is? Me, myself, and I. The great I, not the I am. And the line seems to be very blurry between the two sometimes, isn't it? How we like, I like it this way. We want church ordered. We don't want disruptions, and we don't want chats and conversations, and we don't want the toddler's running up and down here and doing whirls because it doesn't fit a specific narrative. But I think sometimes we forget that maybe it fits God's narrative. We want it a certain way, but God's like, no, I've got a better plan. I always use the analogy of this kid with the two sweets. And you give a 3 or 4-year-old, you give them a sweet, and then you give them a minute, and nice and attached, and then you give them a second one. And now they're thrilled with this one, and now you offer them a third, and they're like, how am I supposed to hold on to that? Because we're too busy hanging on to mine and not holding our hands cupped where we can receive much more. But then there's the fear of something might be taken away too. And then sometimes the Lord takes away good things, which we think are good things. It's actually not necessarily good things. The sculptor Michelangelo is famed for saying, they said to him, you are such an incredible sculptor. How do you map out these huge statues in these massive blocks of granite, of marble? Because some of the statues were carved out of blocks of marble that were like 80, 90 tons. And he says, oh, it's easy. I just take away everything that's not the statue. You're like, yeah. But isn't that what maybe sometimes what the Lord does to us? If we just get quiet and go, okay, just take away everything that's not what you made me to be. Let me not decide how hard the chisel has to land or where it needs to chip or what we need to do. Maybe I need to just take a little bit of a back seat there. So I want to have a look, and if you'll join me in your Bibles on John chapter 12. It's page 2100 in your Bibles. John chapter 12, verse 23-26. And I want to clarify this. At this point in time, the preface this, Jesus is basically telling them, listen, I'm going to be crucified. I will be dying. This is how it's going to be. Now, I always say this, and I think we, many times as Christians who've been in the faith for too long, I don't know if that's the right version, misinterpret this with, no, this is great. You must understand, they've been waiting 400 years for this Messiah. Now he says he's dying. So there's that wrestle where they're going, no, but that doesn't fit our narrative. You still have stuff to do. And God's going, no, come, let me show you how this works. He says that Jesus replied to them, now the time has come for the Son of Man to enter into his glory. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat is planted in the soil and dies. It's the most amazing thing, and that's actually a biological fact. A seed has to die in order to live. You know that a person has to die for a Christian to be born. We have to let go of I and let Jesus come to the fore. Those who love this world will lose it, and those who care nothing for their life in this world will keep it for eternity. So there's always this concept of when I become a Christian, I'm going to lose something. No, you're going to gain something. The problem is that selfishness seems more appealing than selflessness. Our achievements, our authority, our records, I've done this for so many times and I've done this for so many years. And the Lord's like, sorry, what was that? I did that. You were just the instrument in my hands. It's not your glory, it's my glory. Something that's really, really shortened my vocabulary significantly. It's not my testimony. It's the testimony given to me by the Lord who saved me from myself. Because I didn't have very good choices and I didn't have very good ideas. So I don't want to be a heavy. I'm just, this has really shaken me like, wow. So dying to myself involves laying down traditions. You know, we have a family tradition of eating way too much sugar and everything wrong all Christmas long and complaining about being overweight because of it. Isn't that true? But what are we going to do? We'll do it again. Why? Because it's the way we do it. I think I've told this story before, but I worked as a butcher when I was a much younger man. And I had a British lady, ironically enough, her name was Mrs. Kitchen. It really was, and that's how I remembered it. And she would come in and she wanted a leg of lamb sort of once a month because of her very traditional British parents, in-law. And the parents-in-law were adamant that there had to be a roast dinner on a Sunday. It was sort of, it was a tradition. And this roast had to be cut in a very specific way, so which I obliged, and I always thought it was really odd to do it like that because it seemed a bit counterintuitive to how the meat would look nice. Long story short is I asked the question, but why do you do it like that? And then she came back to me and went, I just found out that my mother-in-law was inherited a roasting pan from her mother-in-law that her husband insisted that she uses. And this roasting pan was a source of constant frustration because it was always a little bit small. So she took the roasting pan to her butcher many years prior and said, please, can you make a leg of lamb fit here? And the butcher was having a bad day, so he hacked a corner off the roast, tucked it underneath, and shoved the whole lot in the pan and went there. And it became a tradition. And she said, you know, I've been doing this for like most of my married life, and I've never asked the question why. And I think that's something that the Lord dropped in my heart. Why do you do that? Why is that your tradition? Is it found in me? Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 to 24. And this is so interesting. It starts, it says, you've heard the law that of Moses says. In my version of the New Living Translation, there's a few different versions. It says, you have heard our ancestors were told. In fact, if you go and look in the Greek, it says, you've heard your generations before have spoken about. So there's this inference of this has been something that's come for however many years, all the way back in Hebrew history, that you must not murder or commit murder. Or if you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But they say that even if you are angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. So the tradition was, if I don't act on how I feel, it's acceptable. As long as I boil inside and I just quietly issue my discontent and I pull my lip a bit sideways and everyone knows that I'm actually aggravated, but because I haven't responded to this aggravation, it's okay. It's perfectly acceptable. Hey, it's my net so gemaak, this okay. Right? But it's not. Because the Lord keeps saying to us, it's our heart posture. You know? It's those little things that work on our nerves quietly and slowly, and you think, but now, why am I cross? So if we're cross, if we're angry with someone, the scripture says that that's equivalent to threatening someone with murder. If you call someone an idiot, you're in danger of being brought before the court. There's this, you shouldn't even call someone stupid. And the thing that shook me was, how many times do we get frustrated with people, perhaps even non-believers, who just don't get it? This is confession time for me. You can raise your hand in your heart. It's okay. But we do. We're like, how can you not get this right? Why can't it sink into your thick skull? You know, Jesus died for them too, eh? If they were the only one, then they were acceptable as well. See, it's a fascinating thing that he came to fulfill the law, not remove it. See, under the law, in my BC days, with the things that I got up to, I should have been executed. The scriptures say that you put them to death by stoning them to death. If the scriptures also say, if you are a liar, a thief, a fornicator, you are damned to the fires of hell. It's like, wow, this doesn't feel like gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Like, it feels a little bit like harsh. And hey, slowly, man. You know, I'm a Christian here. Am I right? But I think that the fact is that is the standard that the Lord asks us for, and the standard he asks us for is a heart posture standard. The Pharisees all over the entire New Testament are getting gears constantly. You guys know better. They're being berated. They're saying, you set people up to fail. You're doing this. They did things like they would count how many steps was an acceptable amount of steps to walk on a Sabbath day so that it was still a Sabbath day. If they were farmers and their animal landed in a ditch and they're not allowed to take the animal out of the ditch, which according to the law, they would literally say, well, if I pay someone else to do it for me, but I only actually give them the money on the day after the Sabbath day, I'm still acceptable. And Christ is going, no, you've missed it. It wasn't about this ritual reenactment. It was about, where's your heart? What's your heart posture like? And I know at this time of the year, we often meet with family, and many of us have family who are unsaved, or family who struggle with addictions, you know, we want to with the tani who likes the wine a little more than she should, and we have that person's kid who will break three or four windows on the house, and no matter how many times we ask, please, not here, there. And it's hard to love them, right? It's hard to be consistent in that space. And then as good believers, we say, no, we're putting boundaries in place. You know, we've decided that this is too far and this is far enough. I'm going to pick on the unwed couples. No, this is our boundary. Don't put your hands up, but we all know we cross them, right? No, we weren't going to do this, but we will do that. And I think that's for all of us. We say that this is a standard, but we'll always drift a little bit in favor of. And then, of course, when something comes along, then we go, yeah, but look at what you did. And we instantly just turn into Pharisees. We instantly turn into those people that Christ keeps saying, hey, you're supposed to know the law, not thrash people with it. You're supposed to love them through it. You're supposed to be patient. And I think it's hard because that, in a sense, becomes an idol. Because we see the value of the law as greater than the one who made it. We see the hard boundary that it brings as more important than the love that it shares. You know, the scriptures even continue on in that portion of Matthew as well, where it says, if a man looks at a woman so as to lust after her, he's committed adultery with her in his heart already. So simply looking is and thinking a little bit too long is already putting everyone in danger. And then, of course, the disciples come back at Jesus after that whole dissertation, and they say, but how can we do this? How can we even potentially be believers? These standards are impossible. And Jesus goes, yes, they are. I can imagine the faces at that point in time just going, okay, well, now we don't know what to do. And he says, yes, they are. And then he comforts them and he says, that's why I've come. That's why the Messiah came. So that there's redemption. So that there's the Holy Spirit who can just put that tug in our heart and say, hey, dude, handbrake, U-turn, apologize, walk away. Go home now before this goes too far. Keep quiet before I say something that I want to say, but it doesn't need to be said. Don't put yourself where you're going to be in danger. They talk about people, places, and things. Those are triggers, often for folks who have struggled with addictions. And I also want to clarify, addictions are not chemical, or at least exclusively. Addiction can be to anything. Any compulsive behavior, again, like I said, if you look at the definition of an idol, anything that puts itself anywhere as that resembles anything that is more important than. Church can even become an idol if we're not careful. I'm diligent. I forgot to die to myself. I forgot to be a beggar and just break a piece of the bread I have and share it. I need the badge. I think I have told you guys a story about the humility badge. Hey, another story. If one or two maybe don't know, there's a There's a story about this university. They see this one person as the most humble person they could possibly know. They make a special badge for this person, and they, in a secret sort of flash mob type scene, they give them the badge, and 2 days later they take it away because they wore it. Rather have people say it about you rather than telling them it is you. I always said, be, and then we will see, and then we know. Rather than telling me and waiting for, and then me waiting to see whether I see something of that. Because it sets me up to fail as much as it sets you up to fail, because I'm now watching critically, and that affects my heart, and you're trying to perform, which turns it into an idol, doesn't it? So what is an idol fundamentally is anything that you serve can be an idol. Anything that becomes more important than can be an idol. I know that I had an idol of fishing for a long time. I had this little joke, I used to say, a tug is the drug, man. If I don't meet a wife who fly fishes and gets 10% off her dream nails like me, I'm not marrying her. Guess what God did? He changed that attitude. I asked if she would do that, but she said no. But I did get her to fly fish. The thing is that it became more important to me to do that, and that my walk with Christ had to fit in with it rather than me fit in with my walk with Christ, rather than me be a living sacrifice and settle down and put things away. And at a point I said to the Lord, okay, I'm going to put the fishing stuff away and I'm giving it back to you, Lord, but I can have it back next weekend. Because, you know, the moon is right and the weather's been good and the river's running at the right. I know you know this. You are the omniscient God, but if you don't mind, thanks, man. It was a year. And it was a year until a colleague of mine said, listen, man, I've been wanting to ask you for months now. Would you mind taking me fishing? And I said, I'm there like a prayer, brother. And I didn't fish. I walked after him while he fished. I just felt like the Lord had not said, now you can have it back. And towards the later in the day, he said to me, listen, why aren't you fishing? And I shared the story. And he said, sure. He said, then it's time for me to stop and for you to start. Let's do this together. And it cured me personally. It helped me to settle that thing down. And this has been something that's just come up with me, is like, there are things that could be idols in my life. And I've really felt like the Lord's just putting his finger on a few things and saying, hey, that's my glory, not yours. That's my story, not yours. When you bring it, when you share it, what you do for me, not for you, so that you look good before men. And I want to land with this. It's 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1 to 7. I think many of us will know this. if you could speak any language on heaven or earth and didn't love others, you would be making a meaningless noise like a loud gong or a clanging cymbal. My one friend used to say, you're a coke tin with a stone in it that's being kicked down the road. If it does one thing, it irritates the snot out of everybody. Yeah? It's going to drive people crazy. It's a racket. And love is not an emotion, eh? It's an act of the will. Jesus didn't emotionally go to the cross. He was emotion because of what he was going to endure. But he went as an act of obedience. He chose willingly, purposefully, specifically to do this. And if we think about what God did in that moment with Christ, was that God, in a sense, diminished himself into one of these shells, tolerated all the completely illegitimate abuse under the sun from everyone who should have actually been learning from him, and then submitted to death, that within the cultural context of the shell that he was in, was the most demeaning thing imaginable. And when it was all done, he still said, forgive them. Release them. He makes a convert while dying on the cross next to him. Talking about last minutes. He set such a beautiful example of what love is. I think the biggest thing that's come away from this time for me personally, and hence my sharing, just sharing my heart this morning with you guys, is don't let something rise up in your heart that becomes more important. Don't let something rule over you that determines how you respond. Rather, let the Lord lead you. Because sometimes His silence is not no, it's just not now. You know, you pick a fruit too early and it's not so nice, eh? I'm very fond of persimmons. I don't know if you guys know what persimmons are. They're quite obscure and not many people know what they are. Really, really fond of persimmons. They look almost like a tomato, but they're sort of an orangey color. Now, they may look ripe for a time, but they aren't ripe until they're almost a bit soft. And you definitely, definitely want to try one when it's a little bit soft, because they are, like, I know Jesus made them because they're amazing, okay? But I promise you this, that if you eat it at the wrong time, there is nothing that will give you a spasm in your mouth so sour on earth, really and truly. I don't think a teaspoon of citric acid straight up would be that sour. It is unreal. And you can't seem to wash the bitter out. It just stays there. You can drink water, but it's like a resin. It just sticks. And I always think about that picture, like, when it's not season, it's not season. Just wait. And I think the heart's posture for me, and where I bounced this off the team, and where we felt I wanted to share this, was, in a sense, we've come to the end of a season in JF, and we're going into a new season in our own building. In a sense, we're coming to the end of a year, and we're going into the festive season. And at this time of the year, so many people talk about Christmas, but they forgot about the Christ who we're actually supposed to be celebrating. Now, we all know it's not Jesus' birthday on the 25th of December. Yes, 100%. There's more than enough evidence and archaeological fact that will show us exactly what and where. But I feel like, often like Paul says, he says, to the Romans, I'm a Roman, to the Greeks, I'm a Greek, and to the Jew, I'm a Jew. Because there are times where we need to speak to someone at their level, and not talk down at them like a Pharisee. Sometimes we need to just take a notch down and just speak quietly. And in a sense, like Paul does in that public speaking space where they've got all the busts of all the different gods, and there's one, there's just an empty plinth. And he says, I know about this one. I can teach you about this one. And he teaches them the gospel. Let's put the Christ back in Christmas. And let's start perhaps by putting ourselves a bit to death, putting our heart attitudes and our postures and our entitlements down, and letting Christ shine through.